This is Ryan Holiday, author of Ego is the Enemy, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer in 2016. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's working in modern marketing. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything discussed in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Today, we're joined by Ryan Holiday, and we're going to talk about his new book, Ego is the Enemy. Ryan Holiday is a strategist and writer. He dropped out of college at 19 to apprentice under Robert Greene, author of The 48 Laws of Power. He went on to advise many best-selling authors and multi-platinum musicians. He served as director of marketing at American Apparel for many years, where his campaigns have been used as case studies by Twitter, YouTube, and Google, and written about in Ad Age, The New York Times, and Fast Company. Ryan has written four previous books, most recently The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph, which has been translated into 17 languages and has a cult following among NFL coaches, world-class athletes, TV personalities, political leaders, and others around the world. His first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator, which the Financial Times called an astonishing, disturbing book, was a debut bestseller and is taught in colleges around the world. His second book is the best-selling Growth Hacker Marketing, a primer on the future of PR, marketing, and advertising. Ryan, congratulations on Ego is the Enemy, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I love talking about books and obviously marketing. It's what I do for a living.
Yeah, it's kind of an intersection of several of your life's journeys here. Before we talk about Ego is the Enemy, for those listeners who are not familiar with your work, can you give a brief overview of Trust Me, I'm Lying and Growth Hacker Marketing?
Yeah, so I wanted Trust Me, I'm Lying to sort of be an expose of the modern media system, both from the perspective of, you know, maybe someone who wants to take advantage of it and someone who wants to understand sort of how their news gets made. So I'm talking about, you know, controversial campaigns that I've run for companies like American Apparel. I did the marketing for Tucker Max, who sold millions of books and spent, you know, 7 years on the New York Times bestseller list. What is this sort of outrage culture that we live in, this sort of clickbait universe that sort of determines what is or isn't news? So I wanted to sort of show the forces that that world operates under, because, you know, anyone who's trying to break through the noise has to understand that and be aware of it. And then also any consumer has to understand that this is, in fact, how the news which they make decisions based on it operates. So it's both sort of a how-to and a please don't at the same time.
You had to write about sausage making. Is that
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
So I was wondering if this was like a 21st century version of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle.
Well, so actually Upton Sinclair, after The Jungle, he wrote a book called The Brass Check, which was an expose of journalism. And so which was actually very essential and inspirational to me when I was writing Trust Me, I'm Lying. So yeah, I was trying to sort of expose how it works and sort of, you know, reveal the sort of the secrets of the industry. Mm-hmm. And then Growth Hacker was a book that sort of came out after it. It started as a Kindle single that then got turned into a paperback. It was sort of an experiment that I did with Penguin Portfolio in 2013, 2014. But the idea was, you know, these brands like Facebook and Twitter and Dropbox and Airbnb, some of these fastest growing sort of multi-billion dollar companies of this generation, they really got to where they were without doing much in the way of traditional marketing. Instead, they did what they call growth hacking. And so sort of a journey through this world of a position that's very popular in Silicon Valley called a growth hacker, someone who's responsible for growing a startup very rapidly. You know, what can we learn from that style of marketing? That's what that book's about.
And that book has been mentioned by other authors interviewed on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, it was funny. It started as a 10,000 word book, and then it became about a 150 page paperback, and it ended up selling, I think, much better than any of us expected. But it's been really cool because it's so radically different than how traditional publishing works, which is, you know, you write a proposal, you sell a book, you take 18 months to write the book comes out, and then it either succeeds or it doesn't. You know, we were able to sort of do this as kind of an iterative experiment, which was
kind of like really growth hacking. Exciting.
Yeah, basically we got to apply the ideas in the book to the book, which, I mean, look, I think the best marketing proves the product or explains the product in itself. So Trust Me, I'm Lying is a controversial book. If the marketing isn't controversial, I'm not being true to what I've written. And, you know, if we weren't applying growth hacking to the growth hacking book, it's hard to take it very seriously.
Yeah, the proof would not be in the pudding.
Yes, exactly.
So then can you, before we get on to egos, I mean, can you explain how a little bit about the obstacle is the way and how that is related to ego is the enemy?
Yeah, the obstacle is the way is a book about Stoic philosophy, which is a Greek and Roman ancient philosophy, popularized by philosophers like Marcus Aurelius, who's the emperor of Rome, Seneca, who's a political power broker, and Epictetus, who's actually a slave at one time. That book is Stoic philosophy applied to external obstacles, how you overcome a problem, a difficult scenario, a tough venture. And then ego is that philosophy applied to what I think our largest obstacle is, and certainly our largest internal obstacle, which would be our own ego, the way in which we make our own lives more difficult than they need to be, the way we get in our own way. So one sort of external obstacles, and then the other is about this particularly insidious internal obstacle.
So in the years ahead on Amazon, when people see the obstacle is the way, you're going to see a lot of people who bought this also bought ego is the enemy.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I think there's a saying in book marketing that the sort of the best marketing you can do for your book is to write another book. And so I think when your books sort of circle around the same themes or solve multiple problems held by the same audience, that's like, for instance, when I wrote Trust Me, I'm Lying, there was very little potential overlap for obstacle because they're about radically different topics. Mm-hmm. But when you write something that's at least thematically similar, and in this case, they're very, very similar structurally as well and stylistically, you know, you're able to launch to a base of hardcore fans, which is the ideal position that you want to be in with a book launch.
Mm-hmm. Well, at some point you're gonna have to settle down and and stop writing so many books about so many different topics. No, don't do that.
No, I sort of feel like I have two tracks. I have my sort of marketing and sort of more business style of writing, and then I have my more what I would call sort of practical philosophy. And I sort of have to operate out of both different sides of my brain and then different sides of my brand to market them, although there's certainly overlap with them. But yeah, I think you want to know where each thing fits in your career. Otherwise, you're just sort of, you know, just jumping from topic to topic.
Right. Well, I think it's nice that you can just go write such it's amazing that you can write such different kinds of books. So I read the book and my head is still spinning. And the experience that I had that, and we should state that you're 29, I'm almost twice your age, but as I read this book, which is a phenomenal book for anyone to write of any age, as I was reading it, and we're going to talk about the book, but it took me back through my working career, my life in the Army, my life working on Madison Avenue, all these different jobs I've had. And I was you were giving examples throughout history and modern day, but I was also, I think I almost benefited even more because I knew the kinds of situations you were describing. So I read the book, and then I went back and reread the prologue. So can you tell us the story of how this book came to be and why the title of the book is tattooed on your right forearm?
Well, sure. And look, it means a lot to me to hear that it was sort of bringing you back to places in your life. One of the quotes I have in the book, there's this line from Plutarch where he's saying, you know, I did not so much gain the knowledge of things by the words, but as words by the experience of things. Like, I like it when I hear that I've written about something and then it resonates to people's it is confirmed by people's experiences in real life. I think as a writer, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to speak to some truth in the human experience. And you can sort of only guess from your experience and your life and your research, but ultimately it's got to stand up, you know, to the test of time that is the reader's life. So that means a lot to me. The prologue of this book was a difficult thing for me to write because I'm not in the obstacle is the way I'm very the word I does not appear in the book. I'm not in the book at all. I don't talk about my own experiences at all. I'm talking about the philosophy and then these stories. And so that's originally what I set out to do with Ego. And then I sort of had my own experience with a topic that I felt like was worth sharing. You know, I was the director of marketing at American Apparel for a long time. And in 2014, as I was finishing this book, the company more or less imploded. Dove, who was the founder, was fired by the board of directors. He initiated a hostile takeover with a hedge fund. There's a lot of, you know, negative reporting about this. Ultimately, the company declared bankruptcy and went private. And I had a number of other relationships around that same time with mentors and sort of people I'd looked up to for a long time that sort of behaving in this erratic, dysfunctional, destructive way. And this was also bumping up against my own ego, my own, you know, sort of coming into my own as a writer and what I wanted out of life. And so it's just a very...
And all the success you had at a relatively young age.
Certainly, yeah, it was something I wrestled with, and you know, was trying to process, and so it was just a difficult, chaotic time, and so I thought, you know what, I'm gonna be in I'll write the whole book, and then I'll be at the end of the book, it'll be sort of like an interesting afterword. That's sort of what I was thinking, but as the book was, you know, went through my editor and sort of my advanced readers, like I got the sense that. The resounding feedback was that I had to sort of come to the front of the book, which was hard for me to do. Ironically, in a book about ego, I didn't want to be in it at all. But the story that I tell in the beginning of the book is what that was like, what it's like to be successful early, and the way that can mess with your head, and all of a sudden you sort of want to tell yourself a story. You want this to say something about you as a person. You know, you can get very wrapped up in that success. You're obsessed with maintaining it. You're obsessed with propagating it. And you know, I think the outsized role that this work had come to take in my life, that, you know, I had to do everything perfectly. I had to get my way. You know, it was just sort of wrestling with my own ego, and the sort of precipice that I was staring over was the one that I'd just seen, you know, my mentors and friends go right over the other side of. And so that sort of brought the what was supposed to be a, you know, sort of an abstract study of an idea became much realer to me than maybe I'd anticipated when I sat down to do the book.
Yeah, but it was good.
Thank you. That means a lot.
I mean, it was good that, well, you don't wish things like that on anyone, but there was something that came out of it.
Sure. And look, there's always stuff like that happening. There's always something you can learn. The problem, I think, a lot of times is we're not open to learning it. And so it was just the right place, right time for me. Like, if I had not been writing a book about this topic, would I have been as open or receptive to recognizing those signs? I'm not sure. So I was very fortunate in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to your discomfort at talking about yourself at the beginning of the book, the second paragraph is one sentence: "Who the hell am I to write it?"
Yeah, I mean that was the question. It's like, you know, you write a book about stoicism, it's hard because now no one will ever let you complain about anything ever again. And then you write a book about ego, the first question is like, well, are you saying you don't have an ego? It's like, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that we all have an ego, and then it causes problems for all of us, especially for me.
Mm-hmm.
And if it didn't, I wouldn't have felt compelled to tackle this topic at all.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to the structure of the book. Can you explain, and this is how you organize, the three stages that people find themselves in at any given time in life, and how that's related, how ego is plays a different role in all of them?
Yeah, Sean Coyne, who I'm sure you're familiar with, he writes a lot of amazing stuff for Stephen Pressfield's website. He's Stephen Pressfield's editor, and he was formerly a very powerful book agent. He's talked a lot about the critical importance of a three-part structure, and he gave me some great advice when I was writing Obstacle about the three-part structure. That book is Perception, Action, and Will. This book I set as Aspiration, Success, Failure, thinking that we are at one of those three phases at any time in our life. We're aspiring to do something, where we've achieved some success, or dealing with some failure or adversity. And ego is then the least helpful thing that we can introduce into either of those three phases. And ego manifests itself differently, but with equal destructiveness at each one of those three phases. And so the book is split into those three parts, and then there's chapters about what ego looks like in each of those phases.
Mm-hmm. And can you just define ego the way you do in the book?
Yeah, so I'm obviously not talking about it in the Freudian sense. I'm not a doc. I'm not a psychologist. I have no idea what the actual sort of psychological definition of ego is, or you know what diagnostic checklist would be required. I'm talking about it colloquially, right? Like when, as Bill Walsh says, ego is when confidence becomes arrogance, right? So it's that line where it stops being based on anything real and starts to become this sort of consuming notion of our own self-importance, of our own specialness, uniqueness, when it severs our connection to the reality of the world around us.
Mm-hmm. I know you probably haven't heard this, but in a certain way, the ego, after reading your book, I started thinking about termites.
Sure.
Termites are unbelievably destructive. You don't always see what it's doing. The same thing with ego, the way you highlighted in the book about how cancerous, poisonous ego can be. Can you talk about that? Or let's break it down. Could you talk about some aspects of ego as it relates to somebody who's trying to get somewhere, who's trying to aspire?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to an NFL coach when I was thinking about writing this book, and I was asking about ego, and he said, you know, ego is the cancer of my profession. And I was sort of, what do you mean? And he was saying that, you know, if you make a if you make a draft pick out of ego, you're going to make the wrong pick. If you're deciding a play based on ego, you know, you're going to make the wrong play. And when you're the role of the NFL coach is to strip ego out of the equation, to look at things objectively and rationally and clearly. And I think that's what we suffer to do, or we struggle to do as writers or as creatives or entrepreneurs. The thing that you're doing is difficult enough. The hardest thing is to introduce ego into that equation. So, you know, when you're starting out, there's a quote I have from Epictetus in the book. He's saying, one cannot learn that which they think they already know. Ego is so toxic when we're aspiring to do something, because it blocks us from feedback and from getting the education that we need. Mm-hmm. And when we're successful, it's the same thing. Now we think we've learned everything. Now we think we're perfect, and we're not realizing how things are changing. We're not, you know, we're not seeing the reactions on our competitors or our employees. We're now disconnected from the people that we need to be relating to and working from. And then when we fail, ego is sort of most dangerous, because now we're, instead of learning from what happened, let's say, and saying, hey, look, I made this mistake, or I touched the stove and it was hot and it was bad, you know, this is unfair. This shouldn't have happened. They screwed me over. You know, I'm never going to recover. Exactly. So ego is sort of preventing us from learning. I think most critically, ego is preventing us from learning at every single step of the process, whether we're, you know, at the beginning or the end of that process.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you've got two chapters in the book. One of them is be a student. And in the middle of part of the book, it's always be a student. Two whole stories about the importance of being a student. And those really resonated with me because the listeners to this podcast are folks that are, I think, by and large, trying to get a handle on these fast-moving, big changes in the marketing world that you understand. And particularly somebody who's been doing it for a number of years, it seems very foreign, and for some business owners, it's overwhelming, like it never was before. And they're always, obviously, they're interested in learning, and they want to succeed. Can you explain why not being a student or this notion that you have in there about when you think you've learned it, it's about to get bad?
Yeah. So I think most people understand, or it's more obvious, like why you have to be a student of a craft, like at the beginning of the craft, because obviously you don't know it, so you got to learn it. But what happens is this idea that you've arrived, or that things have, it's harder once you've achieved success to continue that mindset, because now you're having to submit or admit that you're not as good as you think you are. But in fact, there's a quote I have in the book from John Wheeler, who's a physicist, and he's saying, you know, as our island of knowledge grows, so too does the shoreline of our ignorance, which means that the more things you learn and understand, the more it butts you up against other things that you are unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. The more successful you are, all of a sudden you're dealing with problems that were never existed before. You know, when you're a one-man shop, all you have to do is manage yourself. Now all of a sudden you've got five employees. Well, now you have to understand, you know, management and morale and contracts and healthcare and human resources and all these things, right? Mm-hmm. So the more, if you feel like, oh, I only need to learn at the beginning, but you don't feel, if you fail to retain that beginner's mindset, that openness to learning, that curiosity and that drive to improve and learn, well, it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you're right. There's nothing left for you to learn. There's nothing left you can learn. And so you start to atrophy. And so this, like, look, the reason most successful companies are disrupted is because they've closed themselves off to technological change and to trends and to shifting sort of demographics and conditions. And so we have to cultivate that in our own lives. We have to cultivate a sort of a perpetual openness to learning and a desire to expose ourselves to things that might very well threaten what we think we know or what we hold dear.
Yeah, a great example is Kodak.
Yeah,
where they invented the digital cameras, as I understand. They had that patent on it, but they kept it locked up in a closet because it was going to threaten their film business.
Sure.
Now they're gone. They didn't want to hear about it. They was like, no, don't.
Well, and just think about the sort of ego inherent in thinking that you could invent this amazing technology and then prevent the world from having it. Mm-hmm. Right? That it's like, oh no, because film is good for us. We are so powerful that we can actually prevent digital transformation from occurring. That's preposterous. But this is what happens when, you know, you're a multi-billion-dollar company with hundreds of thousands of employees and you're a dominant. There's a line in Billions, which is one of my favorite shows. He says, you know, people call you Superman long enough, you start to think you can fly. And I think that's what happens.
Yeah. There's a chapter in the book that really surprised me. You talked about don't be passionate. And these days, everyone's saying, oh, follow your passion. Go with that. What's going on there?
Yeah, I'm probably going to take a lot of heat for that. I think passion, I contrast passion with purpose. I think purpose is balanced and deliberative and orderly and powerful. And I think passion is intense but disorganized and often foolhardy. I don't think zealousness is a positive attribute. Certainly, I don't want anyone that works for me to be zealous, right? That's a recipe for them screwing something up, right? I want someone who has purpose. I want someone who knows what they're trying to do. They know what they need to learn. They know the relationships they need to build. They know the objectives that they need to achieve. And so I think, I see this with authors. They'll be like, oh, I'm writing a book. It's going to sell a million copies and I'm going to debut on the list and I'm going to become famous. I compare that to someone who's like, look, I believe in this book. I decided to write it because I wanted to reach a large audience. Here's the plans that I've put into place. Here are the relationships I'm going to bring. Here's my budget. What should we do? What are the best decisions that I should do? And let's check these off the list one by one. Mm-hmm. I find that passionate people are distracted and easily easily go off into the weeds, where I find purposeful people are much more likely to achieve their objectives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned another part of the book about maintaining your own scorecard.
Sure.
It was just seems like it's very helpful from a mental health standpoint too. Can you explain that?
Well, look, dude, I was telling you, they want to sell millions of copies. Well, look, it's not in your control how many copies you sell. Right. What is in your control is the amount of energy and effort that you focus on the product itself and then ultimately on the marketing as well. But, if your judgment of whether a product or project was successful is how much money it made or how many copies it sold, you've set yourself up now. You've taken the project and you've put it into other people's hands. Like, so I worked on this book. I'm talking to you. I'm doing the marketing and everything. But ultimately, I don't determine how many copies it sells in the first week, whether it sells 10,000 or it sells 1,000. But I'm happy with it right now. I know that I did a good job. And I know that I achieved what I set out to achieve with it. So when those first sales come in on the Wednesday after the release, the following Wednesday, I'm going to be interested in what those numbers say, but I'm not going to be crushed. And I'm also not going to be elated on them. I'm going to be even about it because, it's all upside for me.
You'll be interested.
Yeah, that's a good word.
Yeah, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the danger of early pride, the danger of early success? I hadn't realized that phenomenon, and then I started thinking about all these artists. Who get successful very young and how it becomes much more difficult for them.
Yeah.
Like Elvis.
Sure. It's hard. I mean, they call it the sophomore slump because most people who are successful out of the gate are either intimidated or distracted or corrupted by that success. And they're not able to ever come close to meeting it again. And look, I've been fortunate enough, although I was successful early, it was over a long enough period of time and it wasn't sort of life-changing, transformative success. So I can sort of see it from both perspectives. But, I'll give you an example. Obstacle came out and it's done quite well over the last 2 years. But I'd already sold this book before it came out and I was already working on it. So I was able to focus on the work rather than, throwing myself a party about how well it did, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, they find themselves sort of intimidated by their success. The expectations change. And so basically the success goes to their head. It starts to whisper in their ear that they're better, that they're, amazing, that they're superior.
And that they know how to do it again.
Sure. Or that they did it again, that they did it in the first place because they're of some inherent genius rather than from hard work and from putting in the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Can you tell the story of John DeLorean and how his ego played a role versus where he had come from at GM?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about DeLorean is that he was a brilliant engineer. His vision for what the DeLorean Motor Company could be has mostly been proven correct. I mean, it's sort of what Tesla is doing now. But he sort of petulantly reacted against the discipline and order of GM. Like, he really hated the bureaucracy there. And I've been as in part of bureaucracy, and I understand that. But he didn't set up any real order at DeLorean. It was, you know, he was invested in multiple projects at the same time. He filled it with sycophants and cronies. He sort of encouraged people to work on side projects at the same time.
He didn't like process.
He didn't. Yeah, he didn't like process. He didn't like order, and he didn't want to be the man. You know, he didn't want to be like GM, which he felt had crushed his creative spirit. And so the result was chaos and disorder and dysfunction, and ultimately, you know, outright fraud and criminality. And so it didn't matter how good an idea the car was. It, you know, Murphy's Law: what can go wrong will. And when a lot of things went wrong, he was incapable of adjusting and dealing with those problems and solving them. And ultimately, he decides, you know, the way for me to solve this is with a multi-million dollar cocaine deal that will hopefully patch over my financial problems. And as we know, that did not end well.
Yeah, it didn't. And it was just a great contrast that you set up there. And it was very interesting. I remember that. But I didn't know about all the background there.
Well, so, I think the problem is we look at people like DeLorean and Howard Hughes sort of with some distance, and we just think of them as these sort of brave, creative mavericks. And they were mavericks, and they were special. But, you know, ultimately it didn't work out for them for a reason. And I think it's worth asking why, and ultimately putting the responsibility on them, not on, you know, they didn't want them to succeed, or, you know, the system tried to shut them down. That's not what it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I am a graduate of Virginia Military Institute, and one of the alumni, most famous alumnus, is George C. Marshall.
Uh-huh.
So I guess, Ryan, you had me at George C. Marshall.
No, he's one of my heroes. He's certainly one of the heroes of the book.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you could share with the listener more about his story and his success. His success is probably also why people don't know as much about him as they would General Patton or General Eisenhower.
Yeah, you know what's fascinating about Marshall? Did you know that he petitioned President McKinley for his military commission?
Oh, I didn't realize. I mean, I've read a biography of him. I guess I did.
We don't realize sort of how that generation, because he wasn't part of the greatest generation. He was sort of older than that. He was
class of 01, 1901.
Yeah, he had a foot in two different centuries, really, and we forget that. But anyways, Marshall's the hero of the book because really he accomplished more than any other of the you know, maybe other than Eisenhower. He's probably our most accomplished World War II general, but he really did it without seeking the spotlight. He did so operating behind the scenes. There's all reading about him. You can find almost no instances of him of any of the sort of petulant, you know, vanity that, you know, that sort of crippled a Patton or a MacArthur and ultimately led to their downfall. And I think what's so profound about Marshall, and he really is a proof of his own sort of humility and egolessness, is, you know, he turned down $1 million after World War II to not write his memoirs. Like someone like Life magazine offered him $1 million to publish his memoirs, and he decided not to do it. And one of the reasons he's not famous, and if it wasn't for the Marshall Plan bearing his name, almost no one would know who he was. That was him deciding, hey, look, I've got too much work to do. I don't care about getting attention. I'm going to focus on my work. Writing this would be a distraction. And so he really suffered in terms of recognition for his egolessness, but he certainly didn't suffer for lack of accomplishment or influence or power. He's arguably one of the most influential people of the entire 20th century, but he did it without needing to be an egomaniac the way that, you know, MacArthur seemed to think that he needed to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell also mention the story about how President Roosevelt asked him if he wanted to lead the D-Day invasion?
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing about Marshall, is he was one of the few generals that did not distinguish himself in any battlefield command. But that was, again, not, that wasn't a decision out of his control. the job of commanding the troops at D-Day was offered to Marshall because FDR felt like he owed it to Marshall. As important as Marshall was in Washington, he understood that every general sort of pined to define himself on the field. And so he said, look, this is yours. Just tell me that you want it and it's yours. And Marshall felt that although he was eminently qualified and he wanted it, that he didn't want some sort of undue influence to make the president decide one way or another. And he said, look, don't think about me. Make the decision that you think is best for the country. And ultimately, FDR chose to have Eisenhower do it, who did an amazing job and maybe the best job that anyone could have done. And he needed Marshall there in Washington. And so that was the decision. But, you know, this is, I'm not trying to make him out to be some martyr, but this was a profound sacrifice reputationally and ego-wise to turn down command of the largest invasion in the history of warfare, you know, an immense amount of glory and attention and power, you know, millions of troops, millions of vehicles, this was the main thrust of the European theater. And he said, look, just make the decision that you think is best. Don't worry about my personal feelings. And I just find that to be, awe-inspiring and amazing.
Yeah, it's just a superhuman control of his own ego.
Yeah, and look, his wife, and I think I quote this in the book, his wife said, look, it wasn't that he was without ego, or that he was some superhuman. It was that he made it important to himself to deal with it, that he kept these things under control. Mm-hmm. And he was able to he wanted the D-Day thing more than anything, but he knew that it wasn't the right thing to do, and he overrode that impulse. And that's what I think makes it even more impressive.
Yeah. Well, have you ever been to that school, Virginia Military Institute?
I haven't. I've been to the Citadel, but not to the Virginia Military Institute.
Well, you should go at some point. It's got the George C. Marshall Museum.
And that's amazing.
And the Marshall Foundation is there. And, you know, I feel very strongly about the book. And I have a very close friend. He was best man at my wedding, and he's a fellow graduate of VMI. And he's now the dean of the faculty there.
Oh, wow.
And he's a retired Army general, and he was also, along the way, he got a PhD in English from Princeton, where he was on the West Point faculty for a while, but, you know, Iraq war vet and all that.
Yeah.
And your publisher was nice enough to send me a paperback and a hard copy. I'm going to be sending my hard copy to my friend who's the dean of the faculty, and strongly recommend that they add this to the reading list, because so much of what you write about, I kept thinking about a VMI, and not just because of what you talk about George C. Marshall, but at a school like that, or the Citadel, or some of these other places, they really, teaching you humility is real important, just like in the military.
Sure.
And well, so it's kind of a Spartan life, and I was just thinking that this is such a natural, and that they should have you come there and speak at the new Center for Leadership and Ethics at VMI.
Well, that would be amazing. I would be completely flattered and honored. I think, you know, I think someone like George Marshall sort of represents the very best of not just what it means to be an American, but what it means to be a human being in the 20th century. This idea that he would, you know, it was the day of his retirement that he gets a call from Truman and says, hey, like, I need you to go to China. There's no one else who can do it. And he does it. And so there was this immense amount of sacrifice, but at the same time, an immense amount of power and talent and the willingness to do those things without, I think, ever. I mean, there's a quote, I think it was from Truman. He says, never did Marshall think of himself. And I just found that to be very inspiring.
Yeah, so I think you would get a lot out of going there. It's right up your alley. And I've read other things you've written just about military history, which is a great interest of mine. And please keep writing those things.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me.
So, Ryan, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I would say that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, ego is making is impeding you and making whatever you're trying to do more difficult. And if you can reduce it even 10%, it's going to make what you're doing that much easier.
Mm, yes. Now, the next question I always ask the authors.
Yeah.
And that is, what books have inspired your work and career? But before you answer,
okay,
because it's Ryan Holiday, we're talking, there's a whole section of your site called Books to Base Your Life On.
Sure.
And I kind of thought, you know, if I asked that question of Ryan Holiday, he might say, well, you might just want to go to that section of my site. But would that be a good answer? Is that whole section of your site about the books to base your life on? And I should also mention for the listeners' benefit, you are reading 200 to 300 books a year. Is that right?
I read a lot. I mean, I could probably spend the next 20 minutes answering this question with so much recommendations. I'll pick a couple books, though. I'll pick two that I think are interesting or unique. So one, Marcus Aurelius's Meditations has probably been the most profound influence on me as both a writer and as a human being. I think it's fascinating that, you know, the most powerful man in the world was sitting there writing these notes to himself about how to be a better person, you know, 2,000 years ago, and that this survives to us. And what I think is so refreshing about it is that he wrote it entirely not for publication. So there's an authenticity and a vulnerableness and a rawness there that it's hard to match. And I think we should, you know, ideally you're writing for both an audience, but you're also not writing for an audience. And so I think there's a model there. And then one of the authors, and he has a new book out about the Rolling Stones. His name is Rich Cohen. He wrote this book called The Fish That Ate the Whale. About Samuel Zamuri, who was the owner of United Fruit. But it's this fascinating biography of what you'd think would be about a pretty boring person. But all his books, Rich Cohen is one of the few authors that I sort of would hold up as someone I would want to be like, you know, when I grow up. Mm. You know, he's just a brilliant writer who manages to teach the reader these great things and really make you think. But then he's also so adept at inserting his personality and his unique worldview into the book in such a seamless, entertaining way. So I would urge people to read his stuff. I could not be a bigger fan.
Mm, wow. So the next question is another one. It's just kind of funny to ask you. I usually say, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading? But I want to make sure the listener understands. Again, on ryanholiday.net, there's the Ryan Holiday reading recommendation email. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so I started maybe 8 years ago. I wanted to create a reading newsletter, but I didn't know what about, and I didn't want it to be about me. So I just started making it about recommending books that I like, and now it's something like almost 60,000 people. So it's been really cool, and obviously it's not bad for promoting my own books too. But yeah, Rich's new book on the Rolling Stones is quite good. I'm trying to think what I read recently. Oh, I read this amazing work of fiction called Mr. Eternity by Aaron Thayer that comes out. I think it's out in August. I don't read a lot of new fiction, but I just loved this novel. It was one of my favorites in a long time.
So that would be like on your. You do these emails once a month, is that right?
Yeah, I do it once a month.
So that would be like on your August one?
It'd be in August, yeah. But I loved it so much, I actually recommended it like in May or April because I read an early copy and I was like, oh, like I never pre-order books, even though I read a lot. I never like something so much I want it 6 months from now. But this would be one of the few that I would pre-order.
Okay, cool. And how best can listeners learn more about you and your book? Is that ryanholiday.net?
Yeah, ryanholiday.net, and the email list is there if you want recommendations.
Okay, great. Ryan, I just want to share with the listener one excerpt.
Okay.
And this is from the beginning, actually, in the prologue. It's always nice to be made to feel special or empowered or inspired, but that's not the aim of this book. Instead, I have tried to arrange these pages so that you might end in the same place I did when I finished writing it. That is, you will think less of yourself. I hope you will be less invested in the story you tell about your own specialness, and as a result, you will be liberated to accomplish the world-changing work you've set out to achieve. The name of the book is Ego is the Enemy. The author is Ryan Holiday. Ryan, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. You're way too kind.
And that closes the book on episode 75 of the Marketing Book Podcast. But please don't let the end of this episode be the end of what you can learn about modern marketing. Visit marketingbookpodcast.com for links to all the things we talked about in this interview and access to free marketing guides from my agency. And while there, make sure to sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. Okay, you've heard from me. Now, I want to hear from you. I love hearing from listeners like you. I've received some great ideas from listeners, so please keep them coming. Likewise, if I can help point you to the right book or other marketing resource, please let me know if I can help. Just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and leave me a message or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Or heck, just tweet me up using hashtag marketingbook. Listeners are doing all three. And please join us next time as we talk with New York Times bestselling author Jonah Berger about his new book, Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.